everyone. My name is Bob Sangster, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I'd like to thank Billy for inviting me to come up here and speak. It's always good to be asked to do anything in AA, and it's an honor to do anything I'm asked to do. My sobriety date is February 21st, 2000. Hope I can stay sober a couple more days here. Pretty sure that I can, based on what I did today. I won't be taking a drink today, that's for sure. Try to do the same thing tomorrow. My home group is the Common Solution Group. We meet in Richmond, Virginia on Tuesday and Thursday. Tuesday is read a topic out of the big book and discuss it. Thursday we read a step out of the 12 and 12 and discuss that. I have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, and I sponsor guys, and some of them sponsor guys, and some of them sponsor guys. So that kind of keeps me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a good place to be so far. It's served well. And I have a new friend that came up here with me tonight. Thank Kevin for riding up with me. And I didn't have my watch. I had a cell phone I was going to use, but he gave me his, and he said it 10 minutes fast. He'd heard enough of me on the way up here. we spent some really good time talking on the way up. So it was a nice ride up, and we saw some pretty scenery. It's good to be here. I was born and raised in Richmond, and in the house that I grew up in, there wasn't any alcohol. My mother had what she called an allergic reaction to alcohol, and I found that out when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I asked her why she'd go to these conferences for her work, and they'd have a bar set up, and all these people would be going over and getting these, all different things, put in these glasses, and she'd just get a Coke or something. I asked her why that was, and she said when she had tried drinking one time, and she just got deathly ill from taking one drink, and she never touched another drink, never intentionally touched another drink. I'll get to that later. But my mom and dad split up when I was 2, and my dad was up at UVA when I was little, and he'd been in the Korean War, came back, went there, and I just remember going up there and there being big parties. You know, lots of commotion, pretty women. He got me a little dog to play with, and, you know, it's fun going up there on the weekends. And everything was going along pretty well. My mom was a single mom until I was 9. But when I was about 6 years old, she was sitting on the front porch and just crying her eyes out. My dad had sent her a letter saying that he was going to get married, remarried. And they were going to go off to Europe for a couple of years. And that's exactly what happened. Didn't see him or hear from him for a couple of years. When he came back, you know, picked up kind of the weekend things, but there was a lot of drinking going on there. And I remember when I was about 10 years old, he and some friends, a couple of guys, made homemade eggnog. And it was a Christmas time. And I got so smashed. We have a little bridge in Richmond. Back then it was called the Nickel Bridge. It's called the Boulevard Bridge. But he had a little Volkswagen, and he was so drunk that I sat in his lap and steered the car. And I was scared to death. And I swore then I never wanted to be like that, and I'd never do that to my kids. Both of those things, I broke both of those vows. And about around that same time, my mom got remarried when I was 9. My stepdad didn't drink either, but at Christmas he liked to have homemade eggnog. And she didn't know that. She didn't know that it was homemade eggnog. She took a glass of it, and she was deathly ill all Christmas Eve and all Christmas Day. So, I mean, she did literally have that reaction to alcohol. Not the one I had. When I was 12, some neighborhood buddies, it was four of us in total, we're at the little shopping center close to our house. They had a liquor store. It's a summer day. A lady comes out with a bag, puts it in her car, drives across the parking lot to another store to get out and go in, leaves her car door or car windows open. We grabbed the bag, head to the woods, camped out in our yard that night, and shared a bottle of bourbon of some sort. I don't remember what type it was, but of some sort of bourbon. And that night, I did things that I normally wouldn't do. You know, we went around raising all sorts of hell, breaking things, stealing things, you name it. Not something I'd normally do. I mean, at my house there were consequences, and I didn't like consequences. But that night, I didn't care, you know. And from that point on, whenever I got a chance, I drank. I mean, I wasn't a daily drinker from 12 or anything, but whenever we could get it, we did. By the time I was 14, it was basically every weekend. By the time I was 15, there were places in Richmond you could go and sit down and drink beer. You know, and there were guys that were older that I hung around with, and I mean, it was a pretty common thing. Didn't have any serious consequences early. Had blackouts before I was 16. The first one was at a party, and they had mixed all this stuff in a trash can, you know, grain and a bunch of stuff. And I had this barber that I would go help pick berries, and he made homemade wine, and it was really good stuff. And so he gave me a half a gallon of that to take this party. And so I traded people part of that for a six-pack and some rum. And I still had half a gallon left, and I drank that and the rum and the beer and the grain. And I don't remember anything other than my friend's mom was trying to get me out of the shower because they were trying to get me sobered up enough to get me out of there. I missed a lot of that night. I know that. After high school, I decided it was more important to get married to my high school sweetheart than to go to college, and that's what I did. As soon as we got our place, drank every night, smoked pot every night, as much as I could. And this went on for a couple of years. And I was working and actually doing pretty good at this place. And they brought this guy in straight out of college. I had to train him, and he was going to start out making 50% more than me. And I thought, there's something wrong with this. Maybe there's something to this college thing. So I'd had some chances to play. I've been recruited to play basketball at college. And, of course, like I said, it was more important for me at the time to get married. So at that point, I stopped drinking, stopped smoking, worked out every day, and 6 months later, I was in college playing basketball. And it just so happened that I was going to go to one school. I was over at University of Richmond working out with a friend of mine who was on the football team there. We'd gone to high school together, and the coach walked through and said, "What are you doing?" And I told him, "Well, I'm getting ready to go to VCU." He said, "No, come back here. I want to talk to you." And this was 2 days before school started, and I started that class two days later. So I was very fortunate in that. And I wasn't on a full scholarship. I was only on a partial scholarship. Didn't think I was getting enough playing time. Got angry and quit. And that night, and this was like towards the end of the first season, that night I stopped at the 7-Eleven, and I got a case of beer and a carton of cigarettes, and it was off to the races from that point until February 21st of 2000. I drank every opportunity I had. It consumed most of my life. I had jobs after I got out of college that were conducive to drinking. Jobs that dealt with the legislature, jobs that dealt with sales and marketing. My first boss, I went into telecommunications, and my first boss introduced me to the Birdbath Martini, which is something like that, up in Washington, D.C. And we'd do that at lunchtime. We'd go meet legislators in the afternoon, and then we'd take some of them out in the evening and close the bars down. That's kind of the way it went. And it was all on the company's nickel. This one, I had a lot of different jobs like this. Later, when they broke up the Bell system, I was public relations director for AT&T in Virginia. And I had a budget of over $1 million a year in 1984 to promote AT&T and go to events that I thought would better our public relations image in Virginia. So I went to every pig festival, pork, beef festival, shrimp festival, you name it. Whatever there was, I went to it. And I also had to go to those things and I had to control my drinking while I was there. Because I did have to meet people and had to talk to them, and I needed to remember who they were and what they said or any problems they might have. But there was a group of us that we'd do that, and then after the event, we'd go somewhere and drink like we wanted to drink. And this was all the time. I don't care whether it was one of these festivals or a legislative reception or whatever. It was always like that. You know, I'd have to control it for a while that evening until I could get out and drink like I wanted to drink. And there was always a group of us, and that's what we did every time. That first wife and I split up. She'd had enough. This was early on in my working career. And I actually went on a blind date. I was dating a girl from out of town, and the girl that was working for me in the office was having a party. And I said, yeah, I'll come, but I probably won't have a date this weekend. She said, no, I'll get you a date. So we had a date. It lasted 3 days. And I was in love. So our first date, we were going out to this party. I had a half gallon of bourbon, a half gallon of vodka. Going to this party, we were, you know, real toasty by the time we got there. And I'm walking up to this house out in Powhatan, Virginia, with, you know, a bottle in each hand. And we're at the wrong house. Not a safe place to be doing stuff like that. But we partied together for 12 years. And split up. And then my third wife and my current wife and I were friends and drinking buddies. And we were both going through a divorce. And decided it would be a great thing for us to get together. And that's what we did. And we drank similarly, enjoyed the party life. And we both were in jobs that allowed us to do that. And so we continued doing that. And then I was out on a golf outing one day with some customers, and golf outings were really, you know, drinking with some golf there. I had a customer that just, I don't care what time it was, if it was 10:30 in the morning, he had to have his vodka and 7-Up or he couldn't hit a golf ball. Just the opposite of me. I'd have a few and I couldn't hit one, you know. But anyway, we'd been out on one of those day-long adventures, and I came home, and she was supposed to be there with our son and my son from my second marriage. No one was at the house. The cars were in the garage. Didn't know what was going on. And I, you know, was trying to figure this out. Took a, I don't know, two and a half hours. I finally found out she had called my mother, who had picked her up and taken her to Tucker's, which is a detox in Richmond. And she thought she was having a nervous breakdown. I said, no, you're an alcoholic. And that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went there to the family portion of that program. I asked her if she'd mind if I, you know, would it bother her if I drank, and she said no. And so I didn't change a thing in my life. I continued to drink, and by this time I was drinking pretty heavy, mostly straight, you know, on the rock stuff. So this went on, and she'd ask me to go to some speaker meetings with her, and I'd be smashed. And she said, oh, it doesn't matter, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody in there is sober. And I'd go, and I'd listen and laugh at the funny stories. But, I mean, I'd literally be smashed to go to these meetings. And I really wasn't going for me at all. I was just going because she asked me to go with her. I was trying to be supportive, I thought. Well, then finally got to the point where the drinking was bothering her, or and the alcohol in the house. And she said, you know, I just can't have it in the house. So I hid it in the basement, in the garage. I hid it above the counter, the cabinets in the laundry room, and that sort of thing. And she'd tell me it was okay if I drank, as long as I didn't have it in the house. And that didn't last too long. And she said, look, I don't want anyone drinking in the house. And for a while, I I'd drink and then come home. And then I decided, you know, that wasn't working. Things weren't going too well like that. So I'd come home, and I'd try not to drink, and I'd sit over by our fireplace, and she'd look at me and say, "You're so restless, irritable, and discontent. Just have one drink." I didn't know where those words came from at the time, but by this time I was drinking vodka out of stadium cups, and she described it like flicking that light switch back there. You know, suddenly I was a different person, and I knew that. I mean, I knew what she was saying, because it was. I mean, I'd take a few big gulps of that drink, and I'd be like, you know, the weight of the world's off my shoulders, and it's going to be okay. But before that, I was balling knots. I mean, I just couldn't. I couldn't not have that drink. And, you know, she's telling me to have one, and she's in the program. And, I mean, I've got her convinced that one is a stadium cup of vodka. But she'd go to put her son to bed, and I couldn't stop at that. You know, I'd sneak to the garage and fill it up again. She'd go do something else, and I'd sneak to the garage, utility room, and fill it up again. And I couldn't, once I started, I couldn't stop, you know, until I was passed out. I couldn't stop, and I couldn't not drink. And then suddenly everything started falling apart. We had a business, and it was falling apart. My marriage was falling apart. My relationship with my oldest son was falling. Everything was falling apart. And I've been going to this, actually, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've been going to this recovery worship service that she'd asked me to go to. And they had a men's group that met on Wednesday nights. And I started going to that. And I'd go in there and I'd talk about my resentments and my anger and this sort of stuff. And everybody in there was an alcoholic, maybe one or two addicts, I don't know, but me. And, you know, I'd go in there and I'd get the stuff out and I'd feel a little bit better. And I'd go home and I'd drink those stadium cups of vodka. Yeah, still couldn't not do that. And finally, as I said, everything was falling apart, and I felt like I was going to explode from inside out. You know, I'd gotten to the point where I was trying not to drink, and I couldn't not do that. And once I started, I had no control whatsoever. And it was just a miserable place, and I didn't feel like I could live another day like that. I called this guy from that men's group who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, "Yeah, I need some help." And he said, "Let's meet for lunch." We talked about what's going on. And he said, "I'm sure I can help you." He asked me about my drinking. And I said I had one, sometimes two, maybe three. You know, I didn't tell him there were stadium cups. And he said, "Well, maybe you don't have a problem with alcohol. I don't know." He said, "But in order for me to work with you, you got to quit drinking for 3 weeks. And you got to go to at least 3 AA meetings a week. And then we'll discuss whether or not you've got a problem with alcohol. You'll find out for yourself." So I went about a day and a half. And, I mean, I had never gone any period of time without drinking for 20-some years. No time whatsoever. I was in the hospital one time for 5 days. I was all, you know, on all sorts of medication. That's the longest I'd ever gone. Other than that, I don't ever remember going even two full days. And I'd gone a day and a half, and I was coming out of my skin. And my wife had a where and when there at the house. And I just picked that book up, saw a meeting that night, and went to it. Nobody knew I was going there. She didn't know where I was going. You know, I just went. Because I made this commitment to that guy, and I felt so bad that I was willing to do anything. I mean, I truly was at the point of willing to do anything, just not to be this way anymore. And so I went to this meeting, and, you know, I said it was my first meeting. It was my first meeting for me. And they have it's a speaker meeting, but they only speak for 20 minutes, and then the speaker chooses a topic. So they chose the first step. They split up into groups, and they talk about the first step. And I'm at this table with a bunch of old-timers there, and, you know, they're talking about their drinking. They're talking about how they felt, the things that happened, the things they did. And I'm identifying with a little bit that each one of them is saying. And I had a moment of clarity that night, because I went there and I could not admit to myself at that point that I was an alcoholic. I couldn't. But that night, they helped me to see that I was. I mean, they pointed out things in the book about the craving. You know, what happens when you have a drink? What happens when you go to a bar and say you're going to have a couple of beers? Well, I close the place down. You know, they asked me about, you know, what happens when you don't want to drink. Well, I go nuts. I go nuts because I don't want to drink, but I gotta do it. I have to do it. I'm going to explode. And, you know, they pointed out the place in the big book where it says that, you know, if you don't have a problem with alcohol, you should be able to leave it alone for a year without any problem. I'd gone a day and a half. And when they pointed that out, I was like, you got to be kidding me. You know, but I had that moment of clarity. They helped me to see that drinking vodka at a stadium cup wasn't normal. Normal people don't do that. And that had become my normal. I mean, that was normal to me. Anything I did was normal to me. I mean, that's what my mind was telling me. Anything I did. And I did a lot of stuff. Not just drinking vodka out of stadium cups. But anything was normal to me that I did. And it was okay because it was me. You know, it was me. If somebody else did it, it might not be okay. But it was me. It's okay. Anyway, I picked up a white. This meeting is called the keynote meeting, and they give out white keys instead of white chips. So I picked up a white key that night. And I haven't had to have a drink since. But right after that meeting, I go outside, and this old-timer that really shared some stuff that helped me to see, that made that light bulb come on. He said, you know, you really need to get somebody to work with and take you through these steps. And I said, well, I've already asked somebody for help. He goes, yeah, who's that? And I told him. He started laughing. It really ticked me off, you know. Got my first resentment in AA already. And I said, what's funny? He said, well, I'll sponsor him. You know, and that was my first God moment in AA. Nobody knew I was going there. I didn't know this guy. He didn't know me. You know, and I've had a lot of moments like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my sponsor and I immediately got to work. We're going through the book, identifying, you know, whether I'm an alcoholic or not. Those guys at the first meeting had helped me do that. But we went through the identification process with the same material again, you know, same material. He asked me about my faith, and I explained to him, you know, I believe God can restore me. He said, well, tell me about your faith. I did. And his question was, how's it working for you? And what? Wasn't working at all. You know? I thought I believed. And, you know, I think I did believe, but I didn't have any actions of that belief. It was just a childlike belief. You know? I believe. So what? Now what? And he said, well, you're going to find out now what. And, you know, we started going through the steps, and steps two and we agnostics, I saw myself all over that. You know, I had prejudices against religion, against people in church, you name it. I mean, I was forced to go to church when I was little. First time I got caught smoking, I had to go to church on Sunday night too, and, you know, didn't leave a good impression. But I truly believe that, you know, the people back then were trying to impart a message on me that I wasn't filtering right, you know. I just wasn't filtering it right. Anyway, we went through that, and I really did believe that, you know, God could restore me to sanity. And, you know, he helped me to see the insanity in my life. I'd been doing a lot of the same things over and over, getting the same results and still trying them and trying them and trying them again. And I didn't know any different. You know, I prided myself as a pretty smart guy, but my thinking wasn't working. It just wasn't working anymore. I mean, every decision I'd been making was turning to crap. And at that point, you know, I turned my decision making over to him. And, you know, he told me that the goal was to be able to turn it over to God. But for right now, I could turn it over to him, because I didn't yet know how to turn it over to God. So that's what I did. I mean, I called him for everything. I didn't make any decisions unless I called him. And I just did what he said. I didn't analyze it. I didn't think about it. And that was probably one of the biggest gifts I've had in sobriety, was I was at the point where I didn't have to think anymore. You know, I just did what somebody told me to do, and trusted that it would work out, because it worked out for them. So we got to that third step, and we actually met in a prayer room of a church, because that was the only place we could find that was private, and did that third step. You know, I didn't know how I was going to turn my will and my life over. And he said, well, you know, if those are your thoughts and your actions, and we're going to show you how to do the actions, and God will take care of changing your thoughts. And he told me that, you know, we're going to do this by you immediately jumping into this fourth step and doing the rest of the steps. And that's what we did. And he gave me instructions for the fourth step. And I left there, I started working on it, and then I got lazy. And procrastinated. It was dragging up some stuff that was causing some pain. And we'd made an appointment to meet to do my fifth step. And luckily, he had to go out of town for business, because I hadn't finished. And then we made another appointment, and I had to go out of town for business. Legitimately, that's true. But I still hadn't finished. And you know, up until that point, I really had, I felt like I was really moving forward in recovery. You know, I was really feeling good about things. And suddenly, I just felt myself sliding backwards, you know, really sliding backwards. I wasn't standing still. I was sliding backwards. And I called him up and said, we got to make an appointment that we can, both of us can keep. I got to get this finished. I got to get this stuff done. And so we did. I went out to his house, and I mean, I tried to be as thorough and honest as I could. I put everything down. I didn't leave anything out that came to mind. I mean, I prayed and asked God to show me what I need to put on here. You know, bring to mind anything that I need to get out. And I did. But on the way out to his house, I mean, suddenly other things were starting to come to mind. And I got out of the car and I was writing those down. We went through that fifth step. And as I went through and listed the people that I was resentful at and why, he asked me to, was I willing to forgive those people? And he told me that, you know, if you don't forgive those people, then you're hooked to them. They're occupying space in your head. You know, so you got to make this decision. Are you willing to make a decision to forgive these people for whatever it is that they've done, whatever you perceive that they've done? And I said, yeah. Yeah. So we went through that and we did that. And basically he told me I needed to make a decision, you know, and then I needed to ask God to, you know, to tell God that I was forgiving these people for this and how it made me feel. And we did that for each and every one of them. And after that, he said, well, you can't use any of this that you brought up against these people ever again. You can't bring it up again. You know, and the only time that you can bring it up is if it'll be useful or helpful to somebody else. In other words, like some of the guys that I sponsor, some stuff that was in there, if they're going through something similar, I can share that with them. But I only can share what I see at the end, because I've still got to go through that third and fourth column. And what that did for me, I think, at least seemed to work out that way, was it freed me up to really see, you know, to leave everything they did aside and see my part in that fourth column. Where was I to blame? Right? Because I'd forgiven them for anything they did. So anything else that's left there is me. And we had a lot of discussion on that, because I'd seen some of it, some of it I hadn't seen, and he helped me see it, you know, as we went through there. There were patterns in my life, and my abandonment was an issue that I didn't realize. But it came up again and again and again. And he was able to point that out, and I hadn't seen it. You know? But it a lot of the actions I was taking were based on that fear of abandonment. Didn't realize that. Well, a lot of them were. a lot of the inappropriate behavior that I was that I participated in over the years was because of that. And faulty belief systems. Anyway, we went through that. It was just an incredible experience. Instead of sending me home, he sent me to his sunroom with my big book and told me to sit there and pray for an hour and ask God, you know, to show me whether or not everything was in place here. Had we left out anything? And at that time, nothing had been left out. Really hadn't been. Everything was in place. We did the seventh step that night together. And he told me then to make my list, my eight-step list. And what he asked me to do was to make my list. And from the things that we had discussed, he wanted me to write out for each one, each person, how that amends would look. What would I say? You know? So that's what I did. I wrote it out for every single person exactly what I would say to them. And I was supposed to say, you know, I did this, this, and this to you, and that was wrong. You know? And or I was this way. I was selfish. I was dishonest. And then I was supposed to ask them when I finished saying that, is there anything else that I've done to harm you? Well, we went through that eight-step list, and some of the people I thought I owed amends to, he said I didn't. And I didn't see it, but I had selfish motives in wanting to make amends to those people. And some of the people that I didn't think I owed amends to, he said I did. And he was right. You know, I didn't question it, but, you know, in hindsight, he was right. He was exactly right. That's why it's been so important for me to have a sponsor that I can talk to and be honest with, totally honest with. And let them know me and know my motives sometimes for things. You know, he even that fifth step, he did ask me, you know, what are some of the good things you've done? And I used to do a lot of things for charitable organizations and this sort of stuff. And then when he delved into why, I did nothing for anyone without expecting something in return. I never did. I don't care if it was in my marriage or anything. I never did anything for anyone. There was a hook if I did something. And he pointed that out, you know, and he helped me see my wrong motives in almost every area of my life. Anyway, we went through that big stuff, and he gave me some great guidance. I'd like to share a couple of ninth step experiences with you. You know, number one, I'm supposed to tell the person, you know, I've done this and this and this, and that was wrong. Is there anything else I've done to harm you? And sit there and be quiet and listen to what they have to say. Because I only know my perception of what I think I've done to that person. And I did that with my ex-wife, and I sat there and listened for 45 minutes. And it was an incredible experience. It was painful. But I got to see the depth of the harm that I'd done. And that made me even more willing to do anything I could to make it right. You know, and she told me what I could do to make it right. And most of it had to do with her son. And I tried to do that to the best of my ability today. She told me that I didn't respect her the way I should. And she was right. She's a great mother. You know, and I tell her she is. Before that, I don't think I ever told her she was. We were always at odds with each other about everything. And, you know, we have a really good relationship today. And her son comes first in everything. She's a great mom. She really is. The other one is I went out to see my dad. He's been living for about 15 years out in the western part of Virginia, near Whitfield. Moved out there to take care of his mom and my grandmother. She's going to be 99 in September. So, she was on the last leg when he moved out there 15 years ago. She's a neat lady. Really sharp. But anyway, he and I had been at odds a lot in our life. We'd gone for periods of a year and a half, 2 years, not even speaking. He was an alcoholic. I don't want to be that way. I'm not, you know, I know he needs to determine that for himself, right? But I can say that today. I went out there to make amends to him. And when I started telling him what's going on in my life before I got to the part of being wrong, he told me he'd gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. No idea. You know? And I'd cut him out of his, out of my life, out of the lives of his grandchildren. And what I could do for him was to include him. You know, that's what he wanted me to do. And that's what I've done. I mean, I would invite him in. Now when he comes to town, I've got two sisters that live in town from my dad's side. Got a lot of different sides there with fathers, mothers, and stepfathers, stepmothers, you name it. But stepsisters, brothers, half, you name it. But anyway, he stays in our house, you know. And we talk often. He's the dad I never dreamed he could be. And he's the grandfather that I just never imagined, you know. And all of it's because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, if I hadn't gone out there to make the amends, I don't know if it would have happened. If I hadn't been sober and he tried to call me and come and do it, I wouldn't have allowed it. You know? It's by two people working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that this was able to happen. And it's changed my life. It really, truly changed my life. You know, let's move on to the 10th step. We've got a little bit of time left. Is 10 minutes left? Okay. You know, taking that daily inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. My sponsor early on said, you've got enough stuff for your fourth step. I want you, when you recognize you've done something wrong, this is before I ever got to the fourth step, right? Before I finished the fourth step. He said, when you recognize you've done something wrong, I want you, as soon as you can, to go back and say, you know, I was wrong for, or I've done this, that was wrong. As soon as you can. Well, the first time I practiced that was with my wife. And I don't know what happened, you know. It wasn't anything significant. I might remember it, but she said something, I said something, I don't know. I didn't respond in a very kind way. And, you know, it had hardly gotten out of my mouth, and I was like, man, where did that come from? And I shouldn't have done that. And I went to her and said, you know, I shouldn't have spoken to you that way, and that was totally wrong of me to do that. What can I do to make it right? You know, and she said, I'd like for you to try not to do that anymore. And what that did, though, was diffuse a situation that when we, something like that went on, we just the cold shoulder, right, to each other. And it might last a day, might last 2 days, I don't know. But 15 minutes later, we were back to being a loving couple. Where before, we would have been really at odds with each other. That really helped me to see the value of, you know, doing something about our wrongs promptly. Promptly. And, you know, I try to practice that today so I don't have so much to work on at the end of the day and the next day. Don't always do it perfectly. And I can say that there are days when I haven't done 10 stuff at night. You know, I try to do it every chance. I try to do it. Try to make time to do it. And on the 11th step, that's something else that I was put on page 86 and 87 to read on Awakening early before I got to the 11th step. And I was told this is practice. It's practice, practice, practice. And I didn't know how to pray. You know, I knew the canned prayers. I didn't know how to have a conversation with God. My sponsor told me to read on Awakening. You know, and where it says we ask, it means we pray. And that's what I did. You know, I had to start asking God for direction to guide my thinking. You know, there's a part there where it says pause when agitated. I was supposed to read that as a reminder for every day because I was a little agitated early on. You know, but that's really has helped me to build a personal relationship with God because it forced me to talk, just to talk, not to say something canned or whatever, but to just talk and ask God for help, ask Him for direction. I'd never done that before, you know, other than a 911 prayer. And this, you know, this wasn't a 911. This was asking him to start giving me some direction in my life, show me what he'd have me be, what he'd have me do. And at one point in my sobriety, early, I was still having a hard time with these decisions, you know, how do I do this? And my sponsor said, Bob, I don't want you moving a piece of paper from the left side of your desk to the right-hand side of your desk without asking God what your next step is to be. You know, ask him, what would you have me do next? And if you don't get anything, whatever's right there in front of you, just do that. And that's, I really took it down to that. He took me down to that simple, okay, to practice that. And honestly, after doing that for a couple of weeks, I really was getting in the mode of asking God for help, for direction. And it took that for me to get to that point. You know, today, the 11th step is probably one of the most important things. I've got to do that. I've got to ask for that direction. I've got to feed myself something spiritually every day. And so we have a daily reprieve depending on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. You know, for me, that's talking to God, going to meetings, helping other alcoholics, you know, keeping my side of the street clean. I got to do that. And I have to do that on a regular basis. On the 12th step, I had a spiritual awakening by then. You know, practicing the principles in all our affairs, that took a little while. I think I didn't immediately grasp the concept that these 12 traditions that we could take home to our relationships and really apply them in our life in that manner, and I've really tried to do that. You know, I didn't try to do it first right off the bat, but I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years maybe I started trying to do that, and it's really made a big difference. You know, I don't make decisions based on self that way. And before, I still was making some decisions based on self without getting input from others, without, you know, our common welfare. That's a big deal in a relationship. And it's taught me to have better relationships, not just at home, but in my home group and everywhere else. You know, I guess I was about 6 months sober when I actually had worked the steps, and you know, we got right into it. Other than my dragging my feet a little bit in that four step, we really went through the steps. And this guy came up and asked me to sponsor him, and I was a little nervous. My sponsor said, "Yeah, you're ready." Next month, another guy came up. "Yeah, you're ready." Well, I saw both those guys today. I mean, they're still sober. They're still doing the deal. And it's really neat to see. I mean, just to watch those eyes that are just that, you know, they're in the headlight type stare, and see a light come on. It's an amazing thing to see. You know, I've sponsored a number of different guys. All of them didn't stay sober. You know, all I can do is pass one to them what's passed on to me. And I know that if they will do what I do, at least today, they'll stay sober. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm going to try to do the same thing I did today. But it's worked. You know, as long as they're willing to do what I do, they'll stay sober. That's the gift, you know, because I've had three sponsors in sobriety. Changed sponsors not long ago. I'd worked out in Vancouver, British Columbia for about a year and a half. I was based out of there and worked there. Spent probably half the time in Hawaii. So I was kind of floundering a little bit. It's like a 6-hour time difference between Hawaii and the East Coast. That's where my sponsor was. So I was talking to somebody out there, and I talked to my sponsor over here when I could. And then I ended up getting his voicemail a lot and not really getting a one-on-one connection. So I recently changed sponsors and having a great experience. Having a great experience. I'm doing the steps all over again. You know, and I love that. It helps me to get to even deeper truth about me. And, you know, that's what it's all about today, is what's truth. You know, because I told so many lies. I believed so many lies. Or I had just so many false misconceptions about things. That today, you know, knowing the truth is a big deal. It's a big deal. Let me pass on one thing here. I'm going to wrap it up. Give you guys time to do what you need to do here at the end. But one of the things that was told to me early on when I was asked about my faith, and then the question was, how's it working? And I was told I needed to set aside all my old ideas. You know, and it talks about that a lot in the big book. But that was a really important thing for me. You know, the conceptions that I had about God, I needed to set aside. And it was hard and it was confusing. But my sponsor explained it that, you know, the truth will come out in this process. So you got to set this stuff aside and go with the steps and let the truth come out. And the truth will come out stronger than anything you've ever had. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, setting those old ideas aside, not just in my beliefs about God, but in my beliefs about a lot of things, has been probably a huge asset in my recovery. Anyway, that's all I have, and I'm glad to be here, and thanks for listening.